A fire bomber is down with 3 casualties in Nevada. It's official. The hole in that Qantas jet was caused by an oxygen canister. And EAA to FAA. Please keep it simple. This is Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for downloading this AeroCast. Here's what's up in aviation for Wednesday, September 3rd, 2008. A vintage fire bomber heading to fight a wildfire near Lake Tahoe, California, crashed shortly after takeoff from Reno Stead Airport Monday night, killing the 3-person flight crew. The Reno Gazette Journal reports the Lockheed P-2V tanker crashed at 6:09 p.m. Pacific time, just off the departure end of the runway. The plane was fighting the Burnside Fire in Hope Valley, south of Lake Tahoe. Reno Fire Department spokesman Steve Frady explained, quote, "They'd been working earlier in the day and were going back for one more drop," unquote. Witnesses told the FAA the plane may have lost part of a wing or one of its engines before the crash. One witness told KOLO-TV the plane's wing was on fire before it came down in a field of sagebrush, which was then set ablaze. Officials said the tanker was carrying a full load of fuel and fire retardant. The aircraft was operated by Neptune Aviation Services of Missoula, Montana. You can find the FAA's factual report on the crash in the text version of this story at aero-news.net. Investigators with Australia's Civil Aviation Safety Authority have made it official and ruled that an exploding oxygen bottle was what blew a 6-foot hole in the fuselage of a Boeing 747-400 flown by Qantas July 25th. Flight 30 from Hong Kong to Melbourne diverted to Manila after passengers heard a loud bang and the crew noticed the cabin was losing pressure at flight level 290. The jet made a safe landing with no injuries reported. After the landing, observers on the ground noticed the 747's right leading edge wing-to-body fairing was missing, and there was a hole in the cargo area fuselage wall behind it, with luggage sticking through. Investigators immediately suspected an O2 canister was to blame, especially after the plane was found to be one short of the number of canisters noted on its manifest, and it was supposed to have been near the hole. The Wall Street Journal reports that last week, CASA and the Australian Transport Safety Bureau issued their preliminary report, stating an O2 bottle sustained a failure. The passengers may have been very lucky. The ATSB says the explosion propelled the bottle up through the passenger compartment, where it bounced off the ceiling, then fell back through the hole it had just created in the floor, and finally out of the plane through the larger hole in the fuselage. Along the way, it severed control cables from the co-pilot's yoke, which fortunately are duplicated on the pilot's side of the aircraft. Control was not compromised. The ATSB has issued 2 related safety advisories, calling for operators to pay close attention to the circumstances listed in the report and to keep up on mandatory O2 bottle inspections and repairs. Qantas CEO Jeff Dixon told the Journal, quote, "Our own investigations agree with the ATSB's preliminary conclusions," unquote. A wider probe into the management of maintenance at Qantas remains underway, unrelated to the exploding canister incident. There's less than a month left now in the public comment period, and the Experimental Aircraft Association is pleading with the FAA not to further muddy the so-called 51% rule that's used to determine whether an aircraft is eligible for registration as experimental amateur built. The FAA proposed changes in application of the rule on July 15th after investigating and discussing concerns for more than 2 years. The agency believes prefabrication and pre-assembly of aircraft kit components and some practices involving professional help are leaving too few tasks to the builder and are becoming a way to simply circumvent Part 23. In its proposal, the FAA wants to move beyond a basic requirement that 51% of fabrication and assembly be done by the builder and instead break it down into requirements for at least 20% of the fabrication and at least 20% of the assembly to be done by the builder, with the remaining 11% required to also fall in one of those 2 categories to total 51%. EAA President Tom Poberesny observes, quote, "Unfortunately, in attempting to address these concerns, the FAA is proposing an approach which would overcomplicate builders' attempts to comply with and the FAA's attempts to enforce the 51% rule. Our primary message to the FAA is, keep it simple." As EAA members and builders have stated, the FAA needs to enforce the current regulations, not create a new regulation through policy, unquote. You can read the complete text of the EAA's comments at eaa.org, and Poberesny encourages home builders to file their own comments before the September 30th deadline. One of the great things about launching rockets from Florida is the weather. most of the time. NASA's Kennedy Space Center managers say they'll follow closely Tropical Storm Hanna to determine when would be the best time this week to move Space Shuttle Atlantis to its launch pad. The earliest it could happen is now this Thursday. If the storm stays on its current track, managers will wait until it passes off the coast of Kennedy and then move Atlantis to the pad, most likely Saturday morning. Forecasts currently show Hanna making a glancing blow off Florida's eastern seaboard later this week, possibly as a Category 2 hurricane. Atlantis is targeted to lift off October 8th on an 11-day mission to service the Hubble Space Telescope. But behind Hanna is her little brother Ike, and the hurricane family is expecting a new baby girl named Josephine any moment now. Up next on ANN, American and BA try again on a transatlantic alliance. Cable News launches live team coverage of a flat tire at LAX. And the British Ministry of Defense faces a lawsuit over the Nimrod crash. You're listening to Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. For 3 years running, the Cirrus SR-22 G2 has been the world's best-selling single-engine four-seat airplane. Today, the SR-22 G2 defines the new Cirrus standard model. Why? We'd love to invite you to see for yourself by taking a ride in the new breed of airplane that has taken the aviation industry by storm. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or on the web at cirrusdesign.com. Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design for a number of reasons. For instance, the noise-canceling microphone used in the Clarity Aloft headset is a high-fidelity, noise-canceling electret condenser microphone with performance optimized for speech frequencies in extremely high-noise environments. Stage performers and musicians use this same microphone because they must insist on the highest level of sound reproduction. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
We're back with more of your Aero Briefing for September 3rd, 2008. I'm Paul Plack. The European Commission is examining a transatlantic alliance which allows American Airlines, British Airways, and Spain's Iberia to coordinate their loyalty programs, schedules, and fares on flights between North America and Europe. In addition to avoiding all the usual hassles of a formal merger, this deal would also give American Airlines increased access to profitable European routes without technically violating U.S. laws prohibiting foreign ownership of a U.S. carrier. The Chicago Tribune reports U.S. and European regulators have blocked two previous attempts by American and British Airways to form an alliance. They are the two largest airlines flying across the Atlantic, and some analysts believe BA would have to give up some of its landing slots at Heathrow to make this work. So, what do the two airlines think will be different this time? Well, for one thing, American notes that access to Heathrow has been expanded under an open skies agreement signed earlier this year, allowing competitors to launch or expand their service to London. American CEO Gerard Arpey tells the Tribune that competitors such as the Star Alliance, started by United Airlines, and SkyTeam, which includes Delta, have been given antitrust immunity on many of the same routes. Virgin Atlantic CEO Steve Ridgway isn't buying the arguments. Friday, he praised the European investigation. Quote, "The proposals would create a monster monopoly, which would mean that BA, AA, and Iberia would be way too dominant on key routes into and out of Heathrow Airport," unquote. The new alliance proposal would also include smaller carriers Finnair and Royal Jordanian. The EU says there's no particular timetable for reviewing the deal, but that it will be done expeditiously. Some old pilots will tell you it's better to blow a main gear tire on takeoff than landing because you'll have more time to plan your response. The bad part is it also gives the media time to show up with cameras and start live team coverage. The three major cable news networks offered breathless coverage yesterday of an American Airlines Boeing 737-800 as it made an uneventful emergency landing at Los Angeles International Airport after blowing out one of its left main gear tires on takeoff. Flight 1586 took off from LAX, headed for Toronto, at 11 a.m. Pacific time. The plane's flight crew reportedly heard a thunk and figured they'd lost at least one tire. They circled Catalina Island for about 3 hours to burn off fuel. LAX spokesman Albert Rodriguez told the LA Times they were just, quote, "taking out some of the danger," unquote. The Boeing 737 has two tires per gear truck on each of its two main gear assemblies and is certified to be able to land safely on just one tire per truck at maximum landing weight, if necessary. Cable news outlets started coverage about 20 minutes before the plane returned to LAX. They were probably disappointed, but the landing was kind of boring. Hey, I have a question. If they wanted to fly for 3 hours to burn off fuel, why not just continue on to Toronto? Don't they have firemen there? Make CNN work to get that sensationalist coverage. Or could it be that Pearson gouges the airlines for the costs of emergency response, just like it does for everything else? Two of the UK families who lost sons when a Royal Air Force Nimrod burst into flames over Afghanistan 2 years ago began a landmark lawsuit against the Ministry of Defense in Britain's High Court yesterday. The Times of London reports the suit contends the ministry failed to ensure that the Nimrod was safe to fly. All 14 men on board died when the aircraft exploded during mid-air refueling. Investigators ruled that fuel leaking through a corroded pipe coupling came in contact with a hot air pipe and ignited. The charges are not isolated to this incident. Assistant Deputy Oxfordshire Coroner Andrew Walker is on record with his conclusion that the Nimrod surveillance aircraft had a fundamental design fault and had never been airworthy. The suit could set a huge and expensive precedent. The families of 25-year-old Sergeant Benjamin Knight and 28-year-old Flight Lieutenant Steve Swarbrick, both of 120 Squadron RAF Kinloss, have retained lawyer John Cooper, who will issue a writ for compensation based, among other charges, on a breach of right to life under Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights. Cooper tells the Times that if the two families win, it could set precedent not only for all the Nimrod families, but also for other cases alleging the ministry has failed to provide adequate equipment to personnel in Afghanistan and Iraq. The family's suit also charges the Ministry of Defense with breach of its responsibilities under the Safety of Work Act of 1974 by failing to reduce known risks facing the crew of the Nimrod. The ministry's own research agency, Kinetic, spelled with two Q's, has found that some safety features requested by the RAF for the Nimrod were left out of its final design, and that many maintenance specialists for the planes lack experience. There's no word on how long the case will take to decide. As many as 17 people are feared lost after their Beechcraft 1900 turboprop crashed into a mountainside in eastern Congo Monday afternoon. The New York Times reports the plane was ferrying 15 aid workers with the United Nations and other organizations to Bukavu when controllers lost radar contact with the aircraft on approach. Heavy thunderstorms were reported in the area and hampered the initial rescue efforts. Helicopter crews finally saw the wreck from the air Tuesday morning, about 9 miles northwest of the Bukavu airport. UN peacekeepers were reported hiking to the wreckage on foot, but with little hope of finding anyone still alive. The plane was operated by a contractor with AirServe International, a Virginia-based nonprofit that flies humanitarian workers. The victims were said to include both Congolese and foreign aid workers and the plane's two-man flight crew. Still ahead, U.S. balloonists celebrate a champion and an amazing survival story. The GA Awards program has a new home, but trouble with its institutional memory. And AARP and NASA hold a joint 50th birthday bash. You're listening to Aeronews.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways. And you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
We're back to wrap up your Aero Briefing for Wednesday, September 3rd, 2008. I'm Paul Platt. From last week's 2008 U.S. National Hot Air Balloon Championship in Anderson, South Carolina, we learned that Joe Hartzell of San Angelo, Texas, has been named the overall winner out of 46 pilots competing in the annual event, held concurrently with Anderson's Great Southeast Balloon Fest. The competition featured some tense moments. A spokesman with the Balloon Federation of America tells ANN balloonist Chuck Waltz of Munich, Michigan, was injured on Saturday when his balloon suffered a rapid descent from about 9,000 feet, possibly due to a tear in the envelope. The gondola hit a stand of trees about 10 feet from the ground, snapping one 10-inch diameter branch when it hit. That may have saved Chuck's life, but it also left him with serious injuries. The good news is he was joking with EMTs. Chuck hoped to be transported home to Michigan this week for further treatment and to recover from a broken pelvis. Competition wrapped up on Monday with Hartzell claiming his fifth national title following wins in 92, 97, 99, and 2007. The organization's Elizabeth J. Domont Memorial Award for Safety went to the Anderson Fire Department this year for its work in rescuing Chuck Walls. For the first time in its 45-year history, the General Aviation Awards Program has a place to call home, and a place where the names of the annual recipients of the national awards can be publicly recognized and honored. A display honoring the recipients of the National Certified Flight Instructor of the Year, the Aviation Maintenance Technician of the Year, Avionics Technician of the Year, and the FAA Safety Team Representative of the Year was mounted in the EAA AirVenture Museum Hall of Fame during AirVenture Oshkosh 2008. Awards Program Chair Joanne Hill commented, quote, "All of these people keep general aviation alive and well and safe. If we didn't have good people, the industry wouldn't survive," unquote. In 2006, Hill approached EAA President Tom Poberesny, who was eager to host the awards at AirVenture. But they may have waited too long to find it that permanent home. It seems nobody can remember who won all the previous awards. So while the plaque has been put on display, there are still several blanks on it. The awards committee is unable to identify 7 past CFIs of the year and 3 past AMTs of the year. It's hoped that visitors will be able to help fill in the CFI blanks for 1968 through 71 and 73 through 75, and the AMTs for 1974 through 76. The committee is also trying to raise $2,500 to cover the cost of the display and its upkeep. If you'd like to contribute to the fund or have a great memory or collection of press clippings, call Deborah McFarland. Her number is 816-347-8400. For a lot of us, opening the mail and finding that invitation to join AARP comes as a real downer. But not for NASA. It turns out this year is the 50th anniversary not only of the space agency, but also of AARP. Tomorrow morning, during the opening ceremony of the AARP Life at 50 Plus National Event and Expo, NASA will present AARP with a photo montage honoring the organization's 50 years of service to the senior community. The montage will include items flown earlier this year on Space Shuttle Discovery. In turn, AARP will present NASA with an oversized AARP membership card to mark the agency's turning 50. The event will be held at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center. Former astronauts Michael Coates, director of NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, and Carl Walz, director of advanced capabilities in the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington, will represent NASA during the event. The pictures are reportedly crinkled black and white ones with some little old lady's writing on the back, and the giant card is so Michael Griffin can read it without his bifocals. Okay, I made that part up. At least they stopped calling the magazine Modern Maturity. And finally, guess who's accused of making bomb threats against Boeing? You might guess it was some radical Islamic terrorist group, but no. 46-year-old Gino Augustus Torella worked as a flexible line worker for Boeing's parts plant in Auburn for 18 years until he was fired in 2005 for sending 3 live AK-47 cartridges to a coworker through interoffice mail. At the time, the FBI conducted a behavioral analysis of Torella and determined he posed a low to moderate risk of returning to attack Boeing workers, although he, quote, possessed many of the characteristics deemed to be risk factors for future acts of targeted violence, unquote. Well, now the Associated Press reports Torella faces a 16-count grand jury indictment for, among other things, sending emails in May which included threats to shoot up or bomb Boeing's Auburn plant. When investigators looked into the threats, they uncovered similar threats against a Shell oil refinery in Anacortes, sent later in May. Officials say they linked those messages to Torella, and then they came across his file. It seems that in the 1990s, Torella was charged with making threats via ham radio, including threats to mow down people with an AK-47 assault rifle. He was fined $10,000 by the Federal Communications Commission. He never paid that fine, but responded by threatening to bomb the FCC office in Kirkland, according to his indictment. Although several witnesses and fingerprint evidence linked Torella to those threats, at the time he received deferred prosecution. In 1997, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Seattle sent Torella's lawyer a stern letter warning Torella to stop interfering with communications on a Coast Guard emergency distress channel. He reportedly continued doing it until 2000. In the new Boeing case, Torella allegedly used a former manager's email address and signature to threaten executives, including Commercial Airplanes CEO Scott Carson and Pat Shanahan, program manager on the 787 Dreamliner. One of those emails said, quote, "I'm going for maximum death and destruction in the workplace," unquote. Agents finally arrested Torella last week in the parking lot of a store that sells outdoor gear. They reported finding over 100 guns in his home. Believe it or not, up to this point, despite his behavior, Torella had no criminal record. You know, if only he'd been caught taking 4 ounces of shampoo through an airport, this guy might have been off the streets years ago. That's the latest from Aero News. Remember to check out the ANN special feature. Today, my guest is Andy Sabula, Executive VP of Government Affairs for the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Andy explains AOPA's opposition to new training requirements for pilots flying near Washington, D.C., and comments on the FAA's plan to start closing down VOR navigation stations in 2010. And if you haven't done it yet, subscribe to our AeroCasts. Find them on iTunes, Yahoo, Odeo, and at our website, www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plagg. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.